Exton Moss Experiment. Adventures in Wine and Space with Simon Exton and Ken Moss.
Hello everyone, and a very warm welcome to the Christmas special of the Exton Moss Experiment. I'm Ken Moss.
I'm Simon Exton.
And this time we are watching The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. This was a BBC serial from 1988, broadcast in six parts. The plot: Narnia is the home of the great lion Aslan. During his long absence, his archenemy, the evil White Witch, places Narnia in an eternal winter. However, with the return of Aslan and the arrival of four Pevensey children, the Narnians are given hope to end the tyranny of the witch. Originally broadcast between the 13th of November and the 18th of December 1988, this was the first of four Narnia series that were broadcast between 1988 and 1990, and I've got a real soft spot for it, but we'll come on to that. Before we start, it's time for a drinky. It's time to wave the tonic screwdriver in the direction of the gin and open up a bottle. This time we are drinking something we have no information about whatsoever. It's a free gift that we've got with our Batch Gin subscription, and it's Batch Distillery's Christmas Pudding Rum Liqueur. It's 30%, which is quite strong for a liqueur, and there is no info bollocks. So this is just eyes down, sniff in. Dr. Exton, what does it look like? What does it smell like?
It looks like rum. I mean, I could also say it looks like a specimen. But it's got that golden glow, and it's almost got a sort of honeyish way it swirls around the glass, and it's heavier than a normal spirit.
Now, I'm not a massive fan of things like rum or certainly whiskey. So I'm going into this open-minded. But it does look very inviting in the glass.
I do like rum. I'm with you. I'm not a big fan of whiskey. I have by accident found one that I don't mind, but and that's only because it's got my name on it. Quite literally, when I was in Belfast, found an Irish whiskey by the Bushmills distillery called Sexton.
Near enough. And
I've had weirder spellings of my name. Anyway, back to the rum.
So what does it smell of?
Spice. Christmassy
it
spice.
Does. It's very Christmassy spice. And it's inviting me into the glass. So we are just having this neat, no ice, eyes down dive in. Ooh.
That's really rather lovely. It's sweet and it's cinnamony.
Oh, that's really nice.
I'm not really getting any sort of raisiny Christmas pudding-y flavour, which suits me down to the ground because I'm not a fan of Christmas pudding or raisiny type dried fruit.
I'm not a big fan of Christmas pud, but I am getting it. And I am getting a sort of an aftertaste of raisins. I really, really like that. That's a lovely, well, it's certainly a lovely Christmas drink, but that's just a nice little liqueur. Now, I can't find any trace of this anywhere on the internet. I think it's just a little tester free gift for Batch subscription. But Batch, make this. This is lovely. It's bloody lovely.
And, you know, this may just be a Christmas practice on the taster audience ahead of full-blown production next Christmas. In which case, fantastic, because this is lovely.
I would buy a bottle of this. This would be exactly the sort of thing that I would buy as a gift, because I think there's a few other people I know would like it too. How many Bernards are we giving this out of five?
Five.
It's five out of five from me. This is a really lovely liqueur. I'm so impressed with this. What a lovely, lovely Christmas drink. Batch, Merry Christmas to all of you at the distillery.
Yes, well done and yummy yum. Merry Christmas to you.
So, glasses in hand, it's time to go downstairs into the under gallery here at Podcasting House and open up one of the doors. This is our repository of all things that are lost, from film, television and radio. What are you rescuing this time?
Well, This is a 1960s spy dramery thing that we're going to watch, and a very popular spy and crime drama from the 1960s was Ghost Squad, every episode of which survives. I think it ran for 3 seasons. It was an ATV production, ran from 1961 to 1964. The first 2 seasons which fully exist were under the Strand Ghost Squad, and I think there are 39 episodes of that. There were a further 13 episodes as Ghost Squad GS5 after the lead actor, Nick Craig, played by Michael Quinn, after he left, it was rebranded as GS5, and there are a very few film inserts for it, but none of the 13 episodes exist. Ghost Squad was an interesting little series because it was a little bit like The Man from U.N.C.L.E. was supposed to be, in that there wasn't any specific lead character in every case, and the organisation had a number of agents, and there are episodes where Nick Craig doesn't appear because for whatever reason it's more appropriate to send a different agent or group of agents. I think Network have put Everything Surviving out on DVD. It's a great little series. There's a wonderful episode of Honor Blackman in the guest cast. We should do that at some point, but GS5 is my choice back from the Black Archive.
It sounds very much your thing, doesn't it? Well, I'm going to pick something which I'm surprised we've never actually touched on before. It's the missing episodes of The Army Game. Now, this was a fortnightly sitcom broadcast live in the early days from 1957 to 1961. And
It starred
William Hartnell as the sergeant.
It was a group of national servicemen, wasn't it?
They were, yes. William Hartnell played the sergeant major. But there's over 100 episodes missing. And I think that went on, if I'm right, that span off into Bootsy and Snudge, didn't it? Which I don't know anything about.
I've seen an episode of those, one repeated. Was it part of the BBC 50?
Pass, I don't know. I know it was a spin-off, but I don't know anything
about it. A long, long time ago, they went to work as night receptionists in a hotel or something like that. It's a long time since I've seen it. Mm. I don't remember being particularly impressed when I saw it.
I suspect it's one of those things I'd find mildly diverting, but wouldn't entirely be my thing. Could be wrong.
Well, I mean, National Service is one of those very of-its-time things. Mm. That I think you a lot want to bring back, don't you?
It's nothing to do with me. I'm interested in the financial side of things that are going on there. Anyway,
so is our current government.
I would like to... you're not going down this route. I'd like to see more of William Hartnell.
On my own podcast.
I'm slamming the door shut on the Black Archive. Leave your views behind.
I'm not sure Spaff wants them.
Here we are, back in the viewing room. And without further ado, it is Ron VT on The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe from 1988.
It's all right, I'm back.
Back? What are you talking about?
Haven't you been wondering where I was?
Have you been hiding?
Poor old Lou. I didn't know anyone even noticed.
I've been away hours.
Batty, quite batty.
But it was just after breakfast when I went into the wardrobe. I was there hours and had tea and
don't
I was
Don't be silly, Lucy.
We've only just come out of that room a moment ago. You can't have been in there more than a few seconds.
She's just making up the story for fun, aren't you, Lou?
No, I'm not. It's magic. It's a magic wardrobe. There's a wood inside it, and it's snowing, and there's a fawn that I had tea with, and a witch, and the place is called Narnia. Come and see.
I had tea with a what?
Let's have a look.
Okay. Well, that was a bit of a nostalgia trip for me. I grew up with this. I was about 10 when this was first broadcast. And it's got very, very comfortable memories for me. On Sunday afternoons, while Mum was cooking a roast dinner, that was on in the background. I'd read all the books. I loved the series. But I'm coming at it from a different angle to you, Dr. Exton. What did you think?
I don't have any particularly nostalgic look backs at this. By the time this was coming on in 1988, I'd have been 19. I was outside of the catchment for it. But... it looks great. The location, which was Manorbia Castle in Wales, looked absolutely stunning. The costumes in general look very good, and it holds together quite well as a story. It's almost as though they looked at Box of Delights and thought, how do we make this better?
Yeah, that's not a bad appraisal, actually. I'd not looked at it that way before, but it does have the same sort of feel or production feel as Box of Delights did. Now, we covered
especially with the animation.
Well,
the animation really recalled Box of Delights, but it's much, much better done here. Instead of some sad little donkey, they've got a combat pelican.
Yeah, it's a curious mix of live action and painted on animation that you don't, I can't remember actually any other program doing it. It must have done, but Box of Delights and this one certainly did. Mm. And it does actually work quite well. It's a curious mix of styles and you have to suspend disbelief a little bit, but it does work.
Yeah, and the other thing that works is the absolutely gorgeous puppetry of Aslan.
Oh, yeah, I cannot fault this. Now, I thought it was brilliant at the time, and I was completely drawn into this story, and the lion was brilliant. I went into it expecting Dobbin. It's not. It really, really does stand up well as a proper lion. The head is magnificent. The body movement's pretty good for two people in a costume. The costume itself is good. I think the only thing that lets it down, actually, is the voice.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a bit later on where he's with Lucy and Susan and says, put your fingers in your ears while I have to let go of this mammoth roar. And it's this whimpery little thing that comes out. But actually, it's not a huge surprise that it looks great because the Aslan Effect had both a puppeteer and a choreographer, both of whom went on to fairly great things. Ailsa Burke was the choreographer on the rebooted Doctor Who from its return in 2005, right the way up until 2017. And what happened in 2017, children?
Doctor Who dropped off a cliff.
And the puppeteer, William Todd Jones, was also the puppeteer on Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and is the head puppeteer in the most recent adaptation of his Dark Materials.
Do you know, I've still not seen those. Are they worth a watch?
I don't know. I haven't seen them because Alan's really not interested in. I don't get a massive amount of time for watching stuff that Alan's not interested in. So when I do, it tends to be Doctor Who.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
It's on the massive pile of things that I want to watch when he's not around. But as we live together.
Yes, it does make it a tad on the awkward side. Getting on to the story of this thing. I've always really liked the Narnia books. I read them at a very young age. I think it was about 6, 7, 8 or something. So I was given a really nice box set of all 7. They were numbered in chronological order.
Oh, so you start with The Magician's Nephew.
Yeah. And for me, that was great. I genuinely went into them thinking that Magician's Nephew was the first book.
Whereas it was the last one published.
It was. And to be honest, if you read them in chronological order, you get far more out of them, as you do with any series, really. But it explains a lot of things that are otherwise would be left questioning in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe and some of the subsequent books. I like the explanation. You historically have not been over keen on it. Things like the lamppost, I thought that was explained beautifully in Magician's Nephew.
Yeah. You well, historically the whole point of Magician's Nephew was to explain the lamppost because one of C.S. Lewis's friends, after having read The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, said it's a great book, but why is there a lamppost in the middle of it? So The Magician's Nephew was the one he started writing next and found it such a challenge. He wrote all of the other books in between, which is pretty good. The Horse and His Boy doesn't really work in the series in the same way. And it's almost as though he'd written himself a book set in Arabia and his publishers said, but you're known for Narnia, so change it into a Narnia book. And I'm not wildly keen on The Silver Chair because it destroys it all.
It's been way too long since I can remember anything about any of them now. I think in the last battle, the stone table cracks, and in the silver chair, there's Puddle Glum and something
about...
Or is
it the last battle that Narnia has destroyed?
Yeah, it's been too long. I could do with reading them again, actually.
In all the copious free time you have.
Yes, we'll skim over that plot point. But it is really a bit of a cut-price Lord of the Rings. And you're not overly keen on that either, are you?
I don't think it is a cut-price Lord of the Rings because it's nowhere near as interminable.
It's just not quite as in-depth a realm as Lord of the Rings. But I've always enjoyed both.
That's a very odd way to pronounce tedious.
Moving on.
I don't think it's a cut-price Lord of the Rings any more than I think The Hobbit is a cut-price Lord of the Rings. They're aimed at completely different audiences.
Yes, I'll give you that. Yeah,
this was very clearly aimed at a children's audience. Lord of the Rings is very clearly aimed at an adult audience. The plot of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe is actually very simplistic.
Yes.
And the big dramatic two-thirds of the way through Aslan getting killed, which is actually quite a horrible scene because it's the whole, it's not just we're going to kill him, but we're going to tie him down and we're going to cut off his hair and all of this unnecessarily unpleasant stuff. And then they kill him and he just magically pops back alive saying, oh, well, there's older magic than the White Witch knows about. It's sidelined to your audience identification characters, because the thing that Box of Delights did better than this is to put the child protagonist absolutely front and centre in the action. This doesn't really do that. They're there to sort of watch what's going on. And okay, Peter has his little battle sequence thing. Susan does almost nothing. Lucy's a glorified ambulance woman at the end. Edmund was actually pretty good. I mean, he was very bratty, but he's supposed to be bratty. He's one of those kids that just needed a good slap.
Repeatedly.
Yes, although we're not allowed to do that now. I'm not sure that we'd ever been allowed to do it to anybody else's kids.
Oh, we got the odd winger. It never did us any harm.
Yes, when the well-balanced individual you've turned out to be. And then he has the brass neck to complain about Lucy sulking when that's all he's done all the way through it. But, you know, bratty teenagers don't have to make sense.
But it did. I mean, we've covered Box of the Ring. Box of the Rings?
Box of the Rings. Or Lord of Delights.
The Lord of Delights.
Sounds like an entirely different kind of film. to be fair, so does Box of the Rings.
Moving on. That, unfortunately, was absolutely interminable, rescued only by Patrick Troughton at the beginning and the end. The middle bit, and there are parallels to be drawn from that.
Are there? The middle bits of Box of Delights makes no sense. The middle bits of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, it's the children being dragged along and not really contributing to the plot other than being there as witnesses to it. But it does kind of make sense.
It does, but it could be scaled down a little bit. I mean, obviously, for the purposes of this serial, they needed something to fill 6 weeks. And they've adapted the book quite faithfully, but it does go on a bit. Just looking through more 21st century eyes, it did drag in places. I thought there was a lot of the White Witch screaming and Barbara Kellerman giving it full bifters.
Well, she did have massive drag queen energy.
I was waiting for this. Did she put you in mind of Romana?
Oh, God, no. Romana as a drag queen would have remembered to put her makeup on her ears. And it was very obvious, particularly in that first sled sequence, that they'd forgotten to make up her ears.
Do you know, I'd never noticed before this, but yeah.
Or it was originally covered by a wig that then got sort of blown back.
Yeah, it was horribly obvious, wasn't it?
And she'd been in some good stuff before then because she was one of the secondary characters. But she had quite an important role in the final Quatermass serial. And she was one of the leads in the first series of 1990, which we must do at some point.
One of the many things on the to-do list. I think one of my favourite characters in this was the White Witch's slave, played by Big Mick. So camply Yorkshire somehow. Oh, we can't do this, Your Majesty. We've got to get out. They're going to get us. I've seen him in other things, and he's actually in an episode of Black Books played a gangster, and he was wonderfully threatening. In this, there was a touch of the camps about him.
It's no good, Your Majesty. We'll never sledge in this, though.
Then we must
walk. We'll never overtake them walking, not with start they've got.
What a delightful character, though. The perfect bit of casting.
Yeah, I mean, the performances were generally pretty good. The child leads, not so much. There wasn't really one that was good. Edmund did a decent job of being brattish, and all the others were just a bit wet.
And Edmund, actually, there's a scene where he's talking to himself and questioning his own actions, and you see that the bratty performance is countered by a much more straight performance. So I was quite impressed by that little bit, because up until that point, he has been an annoying, whiny brat. But then we come on to the rest of the cast.
The Beavers.
Well, we have Kerry Shale
of Monsoon Man fame.
Yeah. and other things. This was probably his most muted performance that we've seen him in to date.
And the costumes of the beavers look quite good until they start to move. And then we move into Croton's territory.
Yeah, they did a bit, but it was all sort of tractator hands flapping about at chest height. Again, that's the Doctor Who fans coming out in us. But his wife, Mrs. Beaver, was Leslie Nichol, who was Mrs. Patmore in Downton Abbey. And I know you're not a big fan of that, but I would never have known it was her until I read the end credits. Now, we'll come on to alumni because we're skating dangerously close to it, but there's one character in there who I actually thought was somebody else. It's Mr. Tumnus. It's played by somebody called Jeffrey... Yeah. I honestly thought it was Jeffrey Beavers, and I'm not entirely convinced it's not Jeffrey Beavers under a different stage name.
Should I be right in thinking that you are a daughter of Eve?
My name is Lucy.
But are you... forgive me. Are you what they call a girl?
But do
well,
you
except
have...
that he looks different.
Oh, I don't know. He doesn't look massively different and he doesn't sound massively different.
Well, not sound massively different. He looks very different.
Possibly. Do you have an alumni list for us?
I do. Richard Dempsey, who was the lead Dreadful Child, ended up playing Tsar Nicholas in The Power of the Doctor. Sophie Cook was in The Worst Witch. Barbara Kellerman, as well as being in this, was a regular character in The Quatermass Conclusion and was one of the leads in The Mad Death and 1990. Kerry Shale, as well as being a Tomorrow Person alumnus, played Dr. Renfrew in Day of the Moon. Mick Walter played the character Grumbly in Psychoville. Keith Hodiak was the Raston Warrior robot.
Now, there was a name that leapt out of the cast list purely because I've never seen him in anything else.
And he played one of Aslan's satyrs, so basically another role mincing about in a bodysuit. Am I wrong?
No.
Right. Ronald Pickup was the physician in The Reign of Terror, and Michael Aldridge, while not actually being a Who alumnus, played Seymour in Last of the Summer Wine for years and years, was one of the leads in Charters and Caldecott, was a major character in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, was Dimmock in the 1960s weirdy detective drama The Man in Room 17 and its spin-off The Fellows, and he was Professor Donati in The Donati Conspiracy, which also starred Romana the Drag Queen.
Just final note on the casting. Michael Aldridge, I thought he played a marvellous part as the Professor. Absolutely nailed that one perfectly. And I've never noticed before, but he had a touch of the Stephen Fry's about him.
Yes, and he was, I mean, his character was the grown-up version of the lead character from The Magician's Nephew, which is why when they come out with all this unbelievable nonsense, he just goes, oh, well, yeah, that's Narnia.
It was a lovely ending, though. It just bookended the serial quite nicely. It is in the book, but what do they teach them at these schools? Rye smiled to camera and then goes back to scribbling in his book. Really, really good performance.
Yeah, and could have been hammy and wasn't. It was just nicely understated. Mrs. Beaver.
Yes.
Why does she have a sewing machine when they don't wear any clothes?
They've got curtains.
Possibly. It seems a little bit extreme for to bang on about a sewing machine just to make a set of curtains that you'll need to do once in a blue moon. Or maybe she makes a load of curtains for other people.
Next.
Yeah, the whole Aslan dead and then suddenly alive again is one of the most blatant deus ex machinas in any kind of literature, really.
Yeah, the whole death being reversed in a certain scenario. You thought that one up at 3 o'clock in the morning, didn't you?
And then he comes back with breath strong enough to melt stone.
Well, we're all a bit ropey in the morning, aren't we?
And finally, the bit at the end. You know, if the White Witch, in that final battle sequence, if she wants to sneak around, she really needs to learn to dress down. Because she was a bit Servalan prowling the battlefield.
Servalan was the one that sprung to mind. Although, no one's going to out Jacqueline Pierce, are they?
Well, no.
I think the only real peculiar bit that properly leapt out at me was Father Christmas turning up halfway through and dishing out an arsenal of weapons.
Well, some people got weapons. Some people got a little bottle of magic plot restorer juice.
Yeah, we could pick holes in this thing. It's probably not too wise to ruin a children's classic.
That's exactly what we did with Box of Delights. So.
Yeah, that's not a classic. They can pin the word classic on it, but it is the most terrible shit. And it was all a dream. Yeah, piss off. What did we think of this thing?
I rather enjoyed it. I suspect it's something that I would have been wildly keen on had I been 7 or 8 years younger.
Mm.
I thought it was well done. I think it stands up now, although it does come across as a little bit slow. It looks gorgeous.
Absolutely, yes. As with most BBC period things, the sets are lovely. Mr. Tumnus's house, the Beaver's house, certainly the actual house, which is a mixture of actual location filming and sets, completely interchangeable. There's the whole railway station sequences. The wood being hosed with fake snow looks completely convincing as winter. So the actual look of the thing, beautiful. Yes, it is a touch on the pedestrian side at times, but I think a lot of that can be levelled at the source material. I had the most wonderful nostalgia trip watching this, and I did enjoy it, but I think a lot of that is because this is a huge slice of my childhood. Would have I enjoyed it quite as much if I'd come to it with fresh eyes? Probably not, if I'm honest. But I think the same could be levelled at anything we're all nostalgic about. It's not quite as good as I remember in parts, but other things I do think, particularly the costume and the sets, have stood the test of time quite well. So, yeah, it's a win from me. But now we come on to a nice little treat that you have sprung on us.
Two surviving episodes of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe of the 1967 ITV adaptation.
This was broadcast in 10 episodes on ITV between the 9th of July and the 10th of September 1967. Only the first and eighth episode survives, and we're going to watch both of them. This version is rather lovely.
Oh, it is.
And I barely know where to begin with this.
Now, beginning the title sequence is marvellous. The music is really creepy.
Sinister. It's got a sinister edge. It starts as a sort of snow globe-esque thing, depicting Narnia as this bubble world. And, yeah, the music is quite sinister. It's not the fluffy 1988 grand sort of medieval kingdom adventure that it became. And the format for this is quite different, ingeniously so, because in order to save money and cope with the practicalities of the time, a lot of the cutscenes are the professor in his study narrating.
Tell me, how would you, Lucy, from the land of Spare where it's always summer in the bright city of Wardrobe, like to come home and have tea with me?
Well, all right, but I can't stay long.
That's the way. Off we go.
So Lucy found herself walking through the wood, arm in arm with this strange creature, just as though they had known each other all their lives. As soon as they were inside, Lucy found herself blinking in the light of a fire. Mr. Tumnus took a flaming piece of wood from the fire with a pair of tongs and lit a lamp.
I thought these were lovely, lovely little cutscenes, because the professor is played by Jack Woolgar, who we know better as
Staff Arnold from Web of Fear, which would have been, I mean, that was 67, so that would have been round about this time. And Mr. Tumnus was played by the actor who played Storr in The Ice Warriors, which again would have been round about this sort of time.
Yeah, it's all contemporaneous. But those little cutscenes, A, they were a great move from A to B while they got the sets ready elsewhere. But also, actually, they worked a lot better. I think that was a really good visual move.
Yeah. And, you know, an awful lot of it is there to describe action that just wouldn't have been realistically manageable with the special effects of the time.
But what little we have of it actually stands up quite well.
The house looks fantastic.
Oh, it does. And some of the bits of action themselves with the actors, because there are no puppets or animatronics or anything like that. It's all actors dressed in animal costumes.
Furries.
Yes. But I mean, for the most
there's
part,
one bit that where that doesn't do them really any favours, because it's in episode 8 when Lucy and Susan are sneaking out of Aslan's camp to follow him to see where he goes. And they're sneaking past the leopard who's on sentry duty. And it's obvious that the leopard is supposed to have gone to sleep, but because it's this big static mask, eyes are staring wide open. So it just looks as though he's utterly incompetent rather than asleep. I suppose you could argue if you're on guard duty, then falling asleep is fairly incompetent. And compared to some of the sets, because things like Mr. Tumnus' cave looks wonderful. That's a fantastic set. And the inside of the tent that the children sleep in Aslan's caravan thing, that looks wonderful. But then you come out of the tent and it just looks really cheaply thrown together and as though it's a school pantomime.
Yeah, there were bound to be some weaker than others, but yeah, that does not look great, Aslan's camp thing.
I would say that I thought that the child actors were much better in this than they were in the 80s one.
Well, acting-wise all round, we had some good names in this. Have you got the list?
If you would like.
Well, go on then.
Right. Bernard Kay was Tyler in Dalek Invasion of Earth, Saladin in The Crusade, Inspector Crossland in The Faceless Ones, Caldwell in Colony in Space, and one of the main characters in Century Falls. Liz Crowther, who played Lucy, turns up in a big Finnish play called Something Inside. I think it's a Paul McGann. It went beyond my time regularly listening to Big Finish, so I don't know an awful lot about it.
It's not a brilliant one, no.
Jack Woolgar was Staff Arnold in The Web of Fear. George Claydon also turns up in the 1980s version of Prince Caspian and the Voyage of the Dawn Treader. Jimmy Gardner played Chen Chu in Marco Polo and Idmon in Underworld. And Angus Lenny, as well as being Store in The Ice Warriors, was Angus in The Terror of the Zygons. And while we were talking about Jack and Ori, or while I was talking about Jack and Ori, the Professor Lynx have a real Jack and Ori feel to them.
Yeah, that is true, actually. They do, because they are two camera and it draws you in. See, I thought the whole thing had more of an intimate story feel than the 1988 version. Bear in mind, that's the one that I grew up with. I have to say, I'd really, really like to see more of the 67 version. I was completely entranced by it, even though it was a lot more basic.
The episodes that we saw, I preferred the 60s version to the 80s version.
I really wrestled with this because I knew that this was going to be a question we'd ask each other. I think on balance, I still prefer the 88 version, but that's because it's the one I'm most intimately familiar with. But it's a really paper-thin decision. Because the 67 version, it's really good. That was lovely. And stylistically, I think I prefer the 67 version of telling it.
See, I don't have that initial emotional connection to the 80s version.
I mean, when you think about it, really, the 67 way of doing it is actually the more logical way of doing it. I mean, I suppose by the time you get to the 80s, it's probably a little bit of a cliched, old-fashioned way of doing it. But stylistically, I think it works better. And it makes the Professor this much more prominent character. Because he's a wasted character, the Professor, in the 88 version. It's this wonderful portrayal that you barely see. Now, that, again, is the source material.
Or he doesn't detract from the leads who are the children.
Yeah, there's that way of looking at it, I suppose.
My recollection of having read the books as a kid is that the character of the Professor kind of bookends things. Then there's the whole bit later on in the books where Peter and Susan get too old to go through the Dorset Narnia and it's left to Lucy and Edmund. And then there's a girl that Edmund's at school with.
Yeah, it's all a bit foggy, I'm afraid.
Ruth or something like that.
I'd be lying if I said I could remember.
Prince Caspian is all four of them going back. Voyage of the Dawn Treader is just Edmund and Lucy and their cousin Eustace. The Silver Chair is Eustace with none of the original four children, but also with his classmate Jill. And the Horse and His Boy, which has no Earth characters. The Magician's Nephew, which has Polly Plummer. And Diggory Kirk is the one that becomes the Professor in Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. And finally, the last battle is Jill and Eustace.
I do feel the urge, actually, to revisit the whole series on the back of this.
The two surviving episodes are on the absolutely wonderful ABC Nights In discs. And these are a fantastic way that Network are putting out individual episodes of things that would never be available for commercial release otherwise. So the only surviving episode of Misadventure, these are things that would just sort of hide away in the archive seen by a tiny handful of people. If it wasn't for Network doing a we'll cobble together a clip show effectively and doing a brilliant, brilliant job of it.
I have to agree. The sort of thing which appeals to archive TV geeks like me and you, they're presented basically as a DVD of totally unrelated programs linked by, it's David Hamilton, isn't it, that does the linking? Yeah, beautifully presented. Just as Simon said, this is stuff that you'd never begin. You probably wouldn't even find bootleg recordings on YouTube that obscure some of these things, but it's great. And on these things are two of the surviving episodes of the, and we watched episodes 1 and 8.
And there is a domestic audio of one of the other episodes. I think it's episode 7, Peter's First Battle.
Oh, we must look that up. Oh, I wish I'd have known that.
Might not be easy to track down. And 1967 was a pretty good year for The Witch in the Wardrobe, because as well as that ITV adaptation, a few months earlier in April, it was on Jack and Ori.
Do we know who read it?
We do, and it's really quite interesting because it was read not by an actress, not by a comedian, not by a singer or any kind of entertainer. It was read by Marion Cleaves Diamond, who was an American neuroscientist, and she's kind of seen as one of the founding parents of modern neuroscience, and came up with the concept of neuroplasticity. So she was
an interesting choice,
but she was absolutely at the forefront of neuroscience from early days, neuroplasticity, and helped understand the role of glial cells, which are the support cells in the brain, all the way through to demonstrating the link between mental attitude and immune health, and was a winner of the Distinguished Senior Woman Scholar in America Award.
All of that I probably wouldn't have known unless we'd watched Lion and the Witch and the Wardrobe. Funny how things turn out.
I wouldn't either. I mean, I'd heard of her, obviously, but I wouldn't have known that she'd popped over to England to read The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe to some kiddies.
As a final thought, telescoping back to the TV series, they are well worth your time. And of the two versions, I would urge everyone to have a look at the 60s ones. I think they are the more interesting of the two adaptations.
To a fan of archive television.
Correct, yes.
Which we're going to make the assumption that anybody who's gone through listening to all of this after however many episodes we've done is going to have more than a passing interest in archive TV. And again, I think we should raise a massive glass of thank you to Network.
Quite right too, yes. Without whom we wouldn't have these releases. So on that note, boys and girls, we shall sign off. Thank you very much for having this festive journey with us. We hope you have a lovely Christmas. We'll be back very soon with more podcasty goodness.
And Merry Christmas.
The Exton Moss Experiment featured Simon Exton and Ken Moss. All featured soundtracks are the property of their respective producers, and no infringement of copyright is intended. Title music was performed by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, and the programme was produced by Maverick Productions. For more information, please visit maverickproductionsuk.blogspot.com or find us on social media.